So good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
My name is Wayne Moskowitz, and I'm your substitute teacher for this morning. Tim is having back trouble, so he couldn't be here. But he told me that I should let him know how everyone behaved, because when he's going to be back in about hopefully soon. And so I hope you all be on your best behavior. My talk this morning is about the ox herding pictures, the 10 ox herding pictures, and particularly on ox herding picture number 10. So the ox herding pictures were drawn in 12th century China by a Chinese Zen teacher who I pronounce his name as Ka Kuan, but I don't know if that's correct, and if anyone knows, speak up. So it's before Dogen. You know, Dogen lived in the 1200s. These were drawn in the 1100s. And Ka Kuan, he drew ox herding pictures, and he wrote a verse on each one, and he did a commentary on his own verse. And they're supposed to depict stages of practice, although we probably wouldn't call them stages. And in your program, there's a picture and a verse and a commentary. The verse and commentary were written by Ka Kuan. The picture is a modern picture that was done in the 1950s by a Japanese artist. And there had been ox herding pictures before Ka Kuan, so I think they were... I think the bull is a Taoist symbol. I think Lao Tzu was pictured riding a bull. But Ka Kuan wrote his own, he made his own pictures, which I haven't given you, which you don't have. He did his own verses and commentary, and then he added a couple more at the end. So, the ox is a metaphor for the mind, or for one's true nature, or Buddha nature. So in the ox herding picture, the hero, who is pictured riding on an ox in the sixth one, is searching for his mind, like the Pixie song, "Where is my mind?" And he's searching for his mind in the sense of he's trying to get peace, peace of mind, and he's lost. And he goes on this journey where he's looking for the ox somewhere out there. He's lost, and his ox is lost. And then he finds the ox, and he starts taming it. And then eventually he rides it home, which is the sixth picture, which is what I'm going to talk about this morning. The pictures up until this time are kind of depicting he's confused, he learns about Zen practice, and he starts practicing it. So he sees the footprints of the ox, he catches it and he tames it, and he's struggling with it. So it's like doing zazen and you're struggling with your mind. And then finally he attains some peace of mind. His mind is quieted and settled down, and he's at home, or he's riding home on his ox. And then Ka Kuan added some additional pictures about form and emptiness and non-duality and all that stuff, which I'm not going to talk about. So what I'm going to do is read the verse and commentary for the sixth picture. I'll talk about my understanding of it and then go through it to talk about how I came at this understanding of these words, and then we can all talk about it. So if you have the program, it's on the front of the program. Thank you. So the verse is, mounting the bull, slowly I return homeward. The voice of my flute intones through the evening. Measuring with handbeats the pulsating harmony, I direct the endless rhythm. Whoever hears this melody will join me. Then the comment is, this struggle is over. Gain and loss are assimilated. I sing the song of the village woodsman and play the tunes of the children. Astride the bull, I observe the clouds above. Onward I go, no matter who may wish to call me back. So, as I understand what Kakuan is saying here is, the practitioner has achieved peace of mind through Zen practice, and this peace of mind has brought him a sense of peace and joy. And also, he's experiencing this in his body or in his heart through his practice. It's not a matter of just understanding the teaching. He has to actually do it to have this experience. And the last takeaway that I draw from this is that this peace and joy that he's feeling is not dependent on anything external. It's not dependent on anything outside of himself. It's experienced here. Those are my three theses. And now I'm going to talk about why I think this. So, the first line, mounting the bull, slowly I return homeward. This brings to mind Manjushri, aside the bull. So there's a Manjushri statue behind me. Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom, of seeing things as they are without fixed ideas of things. And Manjushri has calmed his ox, the wild beast of his mind, and so he is calmly sitting on the wild beast. And when it says, slowly I return homeward, to me that means our practice isn't about going somewhere else. It's about returning to our true self, which is just who we are, like warts and all. So we're not like on a quest of self-improvement, even though that may be our early motivation, but it's returning homeward, not going home. We're already home. And someone famous, maybe Dogen, maybe not, said Zazen is settling the self on the self. So it's already here. And then the next line, the voice of my flute intones through the evening, measuring with handbeats the pulsating harmony, I direct the endless rhythm. Whoever hears this melody will join me. So I think he's saying that attaining this peace is like hearing a melody. Like when you hear a beautiful melody or hear any music, you kind of get it in your body. It's not a matter of understanding intellectually, you know, what the chord changes are, what the intervals are. It's how it makes you feel. And I like this image of measuring with handbeats the pulsating harmony. I direct the endless rhythm. To me, it's like he's keeping time with his breathing or his heartbeat, his pulsating harmony. And then he says, whoever hears this melody will join me. And to me, that's suggesting once you start doing this practice and you start attaining this peace, there's a feeling of what, why would I want to live any other way? So he's thinking, whoever hears this melody will join me. But what I found is if you tell people about the peace you've attained through your Zen practice, they do not want to join you. I'm much better off keeping my mouth shut and, yeah. And then the next line is in the comment, "This struggle is over, gain and loss are assimilated." So assimilated means made the same. So the struggle is over because gain and loss are made the same. When he lets go of ideas of gaining and loss, the struggle is over. And I think that's a big part of our practice here that's been drilled into us of we're not trying to gain anything. Because as soon as you approach your practice as trying to get something, there's immediately suffering. And so it's the letting go of the idea of gaining something that brings this peace. And this brings to mind Dogen, whose one of his big points was practice is enlightenment and nirvana is samsara, that we don't separate them out as different things. So Dogen said in Bendoa, which is the wholehearted practice of the way, "You should completely awaken to life and death as exactly nirvana. You can never speak of nirvana as outside life and death." So life and death means samsara. And then in Shobo Genzo he says, "Just understand that life and death is itself nirvana, and neither dislike life and death nor seek after nirvana. Only at that time will it be possible for us to be released from life and death." So this peace that this practitioner has attained is from realizing that gain and loss are the same, that they're just ideas of gain and ideas of loss. And when you let go of those ideas, he's attained this peace. And this also brings to mind a line from Trust in Heart Mind, which I think is in our chant book, written by Sung San. And he says, "The great way is not difficult for those who don't pick and choose." And I think about this saying a lot. And there's also, I've heard a Italian proverb, "He who has choice has torment," right? So picking and choosing likes and desires, we have them, we can't avoid having them, but when we get so attached to them, it makes us crazy. So the great way is not difficult if we don't pick and choose. And we just accept what is. Not accept in the sense of acquiescence. We have to try to make the world a better place. But we accept that this is the way things are right now. And we don't cause ourselves unnecessary suffering by arguing with the inarguable of this is the way things are. And then Kakuan says, "I sing the song of the village woodsman and play the tunes of the children." And to me, that means he's playing really simple songs, right? It's like children's tunes, so nursery rhyme type melodies. The song of the village woodsman, I don't know what village woodsmen in 12th century Japan sang, but it was probably simple. It probably wasn't like complicated prog rock type stuff. It was probably stuff that was easy to sing while you're walking through the woods. And to me, this means that this practice is simple. Like, we make it complicated because our minds make things complicated. But the practice is very, very simple, of just settling down, following our breathing, and letting go over and over again. It's easy peasy, right? We all know how easy this practice is. And then Coquin says, astride the bull, I observe the clouds above, which to me is a great image. He's riding this wild beast, his mind, which is now calm, and he's not looking where he's going. The beast is taking him home. The beast knows where to go. He's not struggling with the beast because he's at home wherever he is. And it reminds me of this famous line by Oscar Wilde that was then stolen by Chrissy Hynde. We are all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. So, you know, we're all in the muck, but we're also in nirvana, depending on how you look at it. And this poem is depicting a quiet joy and bliss, which to me brings to mind our mission statement. Does anyone know our mission statement? Does anyone know why we have a mission statement? Well, here's our mission statement. Our mission is to help people experience a deep and quiet joy, a joy that arises whenever we are fully engaged in the work or play of this moment. So I think through Zazen we can experience this deep and quiet joy. When we feel it, it's good to luxuriate in it and feel it. It's good. I mean, I think we need to enjoy the feelings of bliss and joy that come up, obviously. But it's important that we don't attach to them, because when we do have these periods when things are going good, they're going to pass. Spoiler alert, sorry. And then we start driving ourselves crazy because, speaking for myself, why aren't I blissful like I was last week? You know, that is not the way to achieve peace of mind. So wanting to have bliss is suffering. Not wanting to have bliss is blissful. And then it ends with, onward I go, no matter who may wish to call me back. And to me, that's signifying that this practice isn't dependent on anyone or anything. So we can all do this no matter what, as long as we have a body and a mind. It's not dependent on our friends going along with what we're thinking and doing, or our family members, or anyone. We can all do this. Nothing can prevent us from doing this practice, right? So that means the good news is you can always do this practice. The bad news is you have no excuse for not doing this practice. It doesn't matter if your child, you know, wants. Well, I shouldn't use the example of what your child wants. Let's say it doesn't matter if your spouse doesn't want you to wake up and go to Sunday morning Zazen. Yes, we have to be compassionate and kind and take care of relationships and spouses, but we can also do this practice. And if maybe the practice, we're doing it at home because our spouse wants us to stay home that Sunday. And because this practice isn't dependent on anything other than having a body and mind, no one and nothing can deprive you of this quiet joy that you experience, because it isn't dependent on anything external. Right? It comes from here. So it's not dependent on whether people are nice to you. It's nice when people are nice to you, but this quiet joy isn't dependent on that. It's not dependent on anything. It comes from here. It comes from returning and settling down, paying attention to what's going on in your body and mind, accepting it, that this is what's going on, seeing it, and if it's negative, just let it go and return. So that's all I wanted to say about the Oxfording picture number 6. And with that, I'm going to open up the floor to discussion. Or maybe we'll just do cold calling. You can say pass. No. So, yeah, if anyone wants to say anything. Otherwise, I'll just keep going for the next picture. I don't care. I have all morning. Bernie.
I don't have any insights into it, but it struck me that maybe the Oxfording pictures serve the same purpose as a lot of the sort of cathedral decoration in medieval Europe, you know, where most of the populace was illiterate, and you know, this was just the sort of cartoon way to spread the word. I don't know.
Interesting.
More about it than I do, but what do you think?
We'll say more about the cathedral.
Stained glass windows in cathedrals, you know, medieval art that's often, you know, whether it be on a tapestry or a forgotten, the sort of three-panel triptych, there you are, print form, that often has a sort of graphical narrative to it that is not in words and was done very explicitly to help people who can't read understand the spiritual teachings.
Yeah, interesting connection. Yeah.
Practical reason to do it that way, that's all.
Mm-hmm. And pictures convey things that words can't always capture. So the picture of this person astride the bull playing a flute is pretty good. It's better than anything I said. Just look at the picture.
Who has seen these pictures?
Does anybody know? I don't know, these pictures...
For the monastics or for...
Yeah. I don't know. Does anyone know? So, I know the way Americans saw these pictures was in, like, the late 50s, there was a book published called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, and the Oxfording pictures, the Kakwan's verses and commentary were translated in it, and a modern artist drew these illustrations, and then it became known in America. But in terms of, this is China, not Japan, ancient China, I don't know who would have seen it.
I think of that because I grew up Catholic, and so we always had the crucifixes around the house, and so you're meditating on this person having been scourged and pierced and all that. And I like this a whole lot better.
Mm-hmm.
This is so much more hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit more when you read about taming of the beast or taming of the mind? At least my experience, I can't even imagine that for myself. So, could you speak a little bit more of, you know, relatively, what does it mean, or what is it speaking? Because I hate having an impossible goal.
Mm-hmm. I think when we do zazen and we sit, at first our mind is like racing and racing and racing. Well, like for me, I was sitting before this talk. My mind is racing and racing and racing. And then I just started counting my breathing, and my mind got calmer. It got calmer and calmer and calmer. Yeah, and so And that calm I can just tap into. So I'm up here talking to all you people and a little nervous. You know, the bowl is, mind is calm. You can tap into that, I think, just from doing the Zazen practice. Your mind can get calm in Zazen. You feel it in your body, and then you can tap into that when you need to, I think. You know, does that, does that help or make sense? Or sure. Yeah.
I'm struck by the metaphor because the bull, the ox, is so much bigger than the person, and yet he's in control of his kingdom. My grandfather had a mean bull, and the only way to control it was to grab the ring in his nose, which my father did while the bull was running at him. So, like a Zazen, you can sit and your mind can calm, or you can stay out of Zazen and let your mind destroy you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are opposing metaphors that are used for Zazen. Like Tim frequently says something like the best way to tame a wild horse is to let it have a wide pasture. So like if your mind wants to have these crazy thoughts while you're sitting, one approach is, all right, go at it. You want to do this? Just go, go, go. And then your mind wears itself out. But then there's another metaphor that I think Katagiri used of Zazen being like a snake in a bamboo pole. It's like really tight and focused, and you're sitting and your mind starts leaning towards this, and you go, nope, nope. So,
I watched a movie this weekend, which at first, I went through the whole movie, and I'm like, oh, this is just a like psychopath horror movie. What is in this movie? Why am I watching this? But it was pretty interesting. It was about a killer who had abducted some girls, and he had multiple personalities, so like bipolar disorder. But he had supposedly 23 personalities, and it came out at the end that.
Wait! Spoiler alert! If you're gonna watch the movie Split, stop listening.
I didn't tell you the name of the movie.
I just did. Alright. Alright, go ahead.
At the end of the movie, I think it says this in the blurb above the movie, there's a 24th personality coming out, and the Beast is the name of the personality versus all the other 23, which is like a human person's name. And what I didn't get quite right away when we watched the movie was that the point was that the Beast was part of this person. It was the Beast who was going to kill the abducted girls and commit the crime. But at the end, I couldn't figure out why at the end it turned out you didn't know that this place where the girls were being kept was underneath a zoo. And you didn't know that until the end of the movie. And then it comes out that the Beast, he had been accumulating the personalities of all the wild animals in the zoo because he worked there. And what ultimately tamed the Beast was the compassion of one of the girls, the girls who didn't express compassion, he had ultimately killed, but the girl who ultimately was able to relate to him and provide compassion related with him and ultimately tamed the Beast.
Yeah, that's good. Interesting. Like, you know, we all have the Beast. We all have our shadow self, our dark side. And I think it's important that we're compassionate to that and not try to suppress it or wish it weren't there or try to get rid of it. You know, we are who we are from conditioning and DNA. So I think with Zazen, we're compassionate to everyone and everything, including the beasts within ourselves. We don't have to beat ourselves up when we see the dark side when we're sitting. We can be compassionate towards the beast. And I assume the little girl got away because she was compassionate to the beast. Okay. Yeah, so end of spoilers.
I sometimes disject between the brain and the mind when I'm meditating. And when things are just going crazy, I understand that neurologically this is a mechanical process. And so I imagine my mind is kind of this amorphous thing, my brain is this gray, lumpy thing. And this amorphous thing turns to the brain and says, thank you so much for all the work you're doing. So my mind is compassionate to the brain and says, I know you're just trying to help. It's not helping right now. And by giving personalities to these two things and having this discussion, I'm struck by how often that works, and the brain says, oh, okay. But somebody has to tell the brain. It's just a bunch of mechanical, neurological things that go on. It's just different brain waves.
Yeah, I love that idea of just asking your brain, like thanking your brain, because we need to have our brain producing all these thoughts, but just take a little break for a little while. Yeah, 20 minutes.
The brain oftentimes acquiesces.
Well, the brain probably wants a break too.
Yeah.
Well, I think that is like the whole metaphor of the bull is this strong, powerful animal that can do a lot of work for you, but he's still, and you need to develop a trusting relationship. I always think of that with bulls. The only way you would ride a bull is by developing some kind of a trusting relationship, and you know that's can be expressed as compassion too, but just how, you know, the bull can run amok if it doesn't have some mind to sort of, you know, acquiesce its power and its strength, but also give it guidance. So I kind of see this way. I liked your brain thing. I thought that's kind of a good one.
Something I hear in this is allowing yourself to be more childlike. Even, you know, the observing the clouds overhead, so the wonder, the playfulness, yeah, allowing that in a way that can make adults that are just focused on being adult-like uncomfortable. So it's not caring about what other people think about you being more childlike.
Yeah.
You can see that as being the crazy person in the village, too.
And that appreciation, that childlike sense of wonder at the just beautiful sky isn't dependent on anything. Like, it isn't dependent on your friends joining in and saying, yeah, I see it, right? We can just do this ourselves. I mean, it's nice if we have people who appreciate it with us, but, yeah, we can always do this simple returning to childlike wonder.
First of all, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I think one of the things I see in this particular verse and commentary is actually relationality. You know, one of the, like, in some of the lines, like, I sing the song of the village woodsman and play the tunes of the children, that the ox herder isn't alone, actually, and that though it seems like a solitary journey, the ox herder with their mind, or, you know, with this idea of enlightenment, actually the sort of the reality is that, you know, that there is no ox herder without the whole entire universe. And so I like this idea that we had a little sign at the temple where I was living that was like, whatever you do it with others. Which is like, oh, that's so sweet, also terrifying, you know? Like, if you think about not changing that toilet paper rule, but then, like, the whole entire community is there kind of over your shoulder.
you do change the toilet paper roll. so that idea that, like, you know, you don't need your friends and family or anybody else necessarily to support you in practice, and you completely do too, you know, and it may not look, the support may not look like, yes, go to early morning zazen on Sunday morning, but it's the relaxing into the fact, for me, relaxing into the fact that there is no me without everyone and everything else that I think isn't me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I get to be both completely connected and totally alone, which is sort of that, like, no matter who may wish to call me back,
mm-hmm.
know, sort of like, I'm already here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We do need the support of the people in our lives. Yeah. And at the end of the Oxfording pictures, the last one is he's returning to the world, returning to the marketplace and having a good time. Yeah. So this is just one step. Yeah. And, you know, I don't mean to suggest that this is a solitary practice or we don't need the support of others. I'm really just talking to myself about no excuses. You know, just you can do this practice no matter what. Because I think when I started this practice, I would talk about all this stuff to my loved ones, friends, coworkers, trying to get them to see, like, listen to this. And, you know, everyone just kind of like, yeah, roll their eyes. And it was frustrating to me. And then it took me a while to realize, why am I trying to convince other people? But my friends and family are all supportive of my practice, but not because of anything I've said to them. Just because I think I'm less of a jerk when I do this practice. But
I haven't heard the melody yet.
Yeah.
Whoever hears the melody will join me. But the commentary is whoever, you know, he's
going to
continue mm-hmm. along, even if there's people calling him back.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any meaning in, you think, the verse ending in a more social thought and a commentary, talking about that pressure or things that keep you from enlightenment?
What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting that the commentary is the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Struggling with not a lot of folks were hearing the melody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is interesting that he wrote both the verse and the commentary. Sometimes the commentary is making fun of the verse, a classic straw man argument. But I took it that for me it's more like the feeling of whoever hears this will want to come along, but that may not be true, right? Because Zen Buddhists are like a small fraction of the world. So that's how it feels to me, like, why wouldn't, having heard this song, why wouldn't I do this practice? And I really can't answer for anyone else. But we're all here, right? That's good.
Maybe the practice is a kind of song that shapes your life, so it's not intellectually telling people about the practice, which also never works for me. But maybe it's just in the way they observe me living my life and in the kind of person I come across as.
Right, right. If you sing the song, maybe they'll want to join in.
There's also just other kinds of songs too that are called to different people. Practicing.
Right.
A different style of music.
Right.
Maybe the most important song is that you know your true self. And so, you know, whatever your true self is, always reminds me of that Mary Oliver poem. Going out and the wind is whipping at your. I can never remember all the exact lines, but. the end of it is, you know, the only real job you have is to actually know yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And to, you know, make friends with that person who you really are. So.
Mm-hmm. And if you have a song that speaks to you and works for you, that's great. And maybe the song is another religion or another artistic pursuit or whatever that is. I never understand why people argue about music. You know, like, I happen to love the Grateful Dead because of my particular conditioning of being growing up on Long Island in the 70s. But I know a lot of people hate the Grateful Dead. I'm not going to argue with them. I mean, who cares? Yeah, so if your song is evangelical Christianity and it makes you happy and you're being compassionate and kind, that's great. Why would I try to convince you to sing my song? Or whatever religion you want to stick in there. Or practice. I mean, this is all about alleviating suffering. And if you alleviate suffering in a way that isn't causing more suffering to other people, and it's really effective, that's great. Sing the song, sister.
Actually, I don't see the song as the religion or philosophy. I see the person on the bull is a particular practice, well, this practice of in your mind, but I see the song just being how you are in the world. And if that resonates with people, that's what they're responding back to.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what their structured practice is.
Mm-hmm. And how you are in the world is your practice, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I try to do this practice in the world, and it's always directed towards how I respond to things.